Today is July 13th, 2026. This is your FinTech briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 minutes, we'll cover the compression of the mortgage lock-in spread and what it means for originator fee income. Japan's Ministry of Finance quietly redirecting pension capital away from U.S. Treasuries, just as Washington needs to refinance nearly $12 trillion. And a savings yield gap that's pushing depositors toward Treasuries and bond ETFs, paying up to 5.8%. The most significant market structure shift right now sits in the housing finance complex, and it's a quieter story than the headlines suggest. According to a thoughtful money analysis pulling from MBA and JCH's Case-Shiller data, the mortgage lock-in spread, the gap between what existing homeowners are paying and what new buyers would pay, has compressed to 180 basis points, down from a peak of 310 basis points back in the third quarter of 2023. Normally, that kind of compression would be read as a healthy sign. The market unfreezing, more sellers willing to list, but origination volume tells a different story. Volume remains 50 to 60% below the 2021 peak of $4.4 trillion. So the lock-in effect is easing, but transaction activity isn't following it up. The broader fintech pattern here is a widening gap between rate normalization and actual market activity. New buyer mortgage rates sit at 6.2% as of the first quarter of 2026, against an effective rate of just 4.4% on existing balances, an inversion of the 2013 through 2021 regime, when new rates undercut existing ones and encouraged turnover rather than discouraging it. Price-to-income ratios are at record highs, and current buy versus rent math implies roughly a 40% monthly payment premium over renting. That's a structural drag, not a cyclical one, and it shows up directly on the income statements of Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, and non-bank originators like Rocket Companies and UWM Holdings, whose valuations remain tightly linked to origination flow. Mortgage REITs Annaly and AGNC are in a slightly different position. Their MSR portfolios are currently benefiting from an extension benefit, low prepayment speeds on 4 to 4.5% coupon books, but that benefit is fragile. If rate cuts accelerate prepayments, that support reverses quickly. Meanwhile, PropTech and transaction-dependent platforms Opendoor, Zillow, stay compressed until existing home turnover climbs back toward the pre-pandemic baseline of roughly 5.5 million annualized sales. Looking at the regulatory landscape internationally, the more consequential development today isn't domestic at all. It's coming out of Tokyo. Darius Dale of 42 Macro reports that Japan's Ministry of Finance has begun signaling to pension funds, including the $1.8 trillion government pension investment fund, to tilt allocations back toward domestic assets. That signal has already lifted the yen off four-decade lows and rallied Japanese government bonds. Here's why that matters for anyone watching U.S. rates. Japan is the world's third-largest net international investment surplus economy, holding a $3.5 trillion surplus. Any durable pullback in Japan's outbound capital removes what has historically been one of the most significant marginal buyers of U.S. Treasuries, at precisely the moment the U.S. Treasury needs to refinance close to $12 trillion over the next 12 months. The broader fintech pattern compounds from there. Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi has proposed a $2.3 trillion 14-year fiscal program, with more than 25% earmarked for AI and semiconductor investment domestically. Meaning Japan isn't just redirecting existing capital, it's actively creating new domestic demand for that capital. Dale frames this alongside European remilitarization and Chinese economic decoupling as part of a structural decline in global savings growth, now near record lows on a trailing 10-year basis relative to its long-run average. On the policy side, Dale ties the nomination of Kevin Warsh to succeed Jay Powell directly to this financing pressure, calling him, in Dale's words, the most credible dove in hawk's clothing, implying continued accommodation and effective monetization of Treasury issuance, regardless of his reputation. Separately, and this part is unverified independently, a Felix Friends presenter attributes a preference for holding rates near current levels to a Fed official identified as Kevin Walsh, citing inflation above 4% and rising energy costs. That characterization isn't corroborated by official Fed communication in the source material, so treat it as unconfirmed. For Treasury and Asset Liability Management desks, the operative read is that reduced Japanese demand, layered onto continued policy accommodation, raises the odds of JGB and UST yield volatility that could pressure held to maturity and available for sale securities portfolios across the banking sector. The third thread today is deposit economics, and the numbers are stark. A Felix Friends analysis puts the average U.S. bank savings yield at 0.38% against inflation running at 4.2%. That's a substantial ongoing erosion of real purchasing power for anyone leaving cash in a traditional savings account. Meanwhile, Treasury and bond ETF alternatives are yielding up to 5.8%. The broader fintech pattern here is disintermediation risk accelerating, not as a future scenario, but as a present one. Every basis point of that gap is an incentive for depositors to move balances out of bank deposits and into money market and bond ETF alternatives, which pressures the low-cost funding base that banks have relied on for net interest margin. There's also a structural opportunity forming beneath these pressures, and it's worth flagging even though it's earlier stage. A Greg Eisenberg-hosted discussion describes an operator provisioning an autonomous AI agent with its own email, phone number, and debit card to transact independently, a use case that sits outside what most core card-issuing platforms are built for, since they assume a single verified natural person account holder. Building agent-aware issuing capability is estimated at $2 to $8 million in issuer-processor API extensions over 6 to 12 months for processors like Marqeta, Galileo, and Highnote, materially cheaper than replacing core banking infrastructure. That positions banking-as-a-service platforms to capture a new product category ahead of incumbent card issuers, echoing Stripe's earlier capture of API-first payments before bank incumbents responded. Looking at the regulatory landscape here, too, there's a real gap. No U.S. framework currently defines KYC or AML obligations for AI agents as account holders, since Bank Secrecy Act rules require a natural person or legal entity as beneficial owner. That creates ambiguous Regulation E liability for unauthorized transaction disputes, and it lands against a backdrop of FDIC and OCC enforcement actions against BaaS partner banks, including Blue Ridge and Evolve, for BSA and AML failures. Any issuer extending cards to agent-controlled workflows without solid audit trails is stepping into elevated scrutiny risk. Fintech thesis update. What changed in the outlook today is the alignment of three separate pressures into one direction. Mortgage economics show normalization without recovery. Spreads compress, but volume doesn't follow, keeping fee income structurally impaired at originators. Sovereign funding risk is rising as Japan's capital retreats homeward, just as U.S. refinancing needs peak near $12 trillion, raising the probability of rate volatility that touches every bank's securities portfolio. And deposit funding is eroding in real time as the yield gap between savings accounts and treasury alternatives widens past 4 percentage points. Layered against all of this, agent-aware payment infrastructure is emerging as the one clear build-now opportunity, with a 12 to 24-month window before incumbents catch up. Institutions treating any of these as distant contingencies rather than near-term planning priorities are already behind. Watching the rails. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.